والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه وبارك وسلم. So we're looking at hadith number 6 of the 40 hadith of Imam Nawawi. So if you want to pull it up, you can just pull up on your phone if you don't have the text. Google something like Imam Nawawi's 40 hadith number 6. This is a hadith that starts in al-halal bayyin wa in al-haram bayyin. So we just take a quick minute to bring it up. Last week we started to look at this hadith and its first part. We talked about the narrator of the hadith, Nu'man ibn Bashir radiallahu anhu, a little bit about who he was, one of the first children born in Medina, the first of the Ansar, after the grandson of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu was born. Nu'man ibn Bashir was born 6 months later. We talked about his eloquence as an orator, as a poet, and other things relevant to who he was. And what we'll be doing as we're going through these hadith is to also talk about the companions that are narrating them, just to be able to offer a little bit more insight contextually. So, for example, knowing that Nu'man ibn Bashir is the narrator of this hadith, and he was one of the first children born in Medina, means that he was a child during the time of the latter part of Revelation. And the mode in which he's explaining things, we want to be able to think and understand also, not with a grain of salt because he's a child, but this is a child who's being exposed to these types of teachings. And the system of kind of narrating prophetic tradition wasn't something that discluded children of a certain age just because they were children, but he is at a young age at this time. Then we talked about the first part of the hadith, in al-halal bayyin wa in al-haram bayyin, and the concept of like what's called the ahkam sharia, the categories of the legal rulings in Islam, that every action that we undertake can essentially fall into one of these, typically like structured around 5 categories, in some schools of thought, 7. Now we wanted to go through kind of the rest of the hadith today. So just 2 things really quickly. We're going to take a pause probably at around like 7:15, and then we're going to shift into another class that we're starting today. That's just on the essentials of Ramadan, which we're going to use as like a prep for Ramadan. We did one at 4 earlier for students. This is open to everyone, students, community members, etc. But we'll go through, similar to how we went through the fiqh of prayer in the summer, and went through it in a lot of detail, we'll kind of be breaking down Ramadan within the framework of just what you can anticipate. Whether this is the first Ramadan you're observing, which is true for many of us. It might be the first Ramadan as a Muslim for some of us. It might be the first of many Ramadans that we've observed, but are still trying to make sense of what religion means, or are just being exposed to religion. So just to have kind of a mindfulness of the room and the diversity in the room. But that second kind of class that we're starting today on Mondays, is going to be focused on just the essentials of Ramadan, kind of start to finish, so that we're prepped as best as we can, but we can also kind of revise and review for those who need that, as well as just get exposed for the first time. So, does everybody have the hadith in front of them? Hadith number 6 of the Arba'een of Imam Nawawi. It's hadith number 6 of the 40 hadith of Imam Nawawi. Can somebody read it? In English or Arabic. We're going to do both. Yeah, fadl. Okay. He'll go first then.
In Arabic?
Yeah,
in Arabic. عن أبي عبد الله نعمان بن بشير رضي الله عنهما قال سمعت رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم يقول إن الحلال بين وإن الحرام بين وبينهما أمور مشتبهات لا يعلمهن كثير من الناس. فمن اتقى الشبهات فقد استبرأ لدينه وعرضه فمن وقع في الشبهات وقع في الحرام كراه يرعى حول فيما يشرك أي يقع فيه ألا وإن لكل ملك حمى ألا وإن حقي ألا وإن حمى الله محارمه ألا وإن في الجسد مضغة إذا صلحت صلح الجسد كله وإذا فسدت فسد الجسد كله ألا وهي القلب رواه البخاري ومسلم.
Farish, you want to read the English?
The halal is clear and the haram is clear, and between them are matters unclear that are unknown to most people. Whoever is wary of these unclear matters has absolved his religion and honor, and whoever indulges in them has indulged in the haram. It is like a shepherd who herds his sheep too close to preserved sanctuary, and they will eventually graze in it. Every king has a sanctuary, and the sanctuary of Allah is what he has made haram. There lies within the body a piece of flesh. It is sound. The whole body is sound. And if it is corrupted, the whole body is corrupted. Verily, this piece is the heart. Bukhari Muslim.
Jazakallah khair. So we looked at the first part of this hadith last time. If you missed it, there's recordings up online. And the first five hadith we have up online, we've been going through them in detail. This text is a text that's like a foundational collection of hadith. Imam Nawawi rahimahullah, his 40 hadith collection, it's got actually 42 hadith in it. But it's something that gives us a lot of insight on a variety of topics. And what you want to try to do is familiarize yourself with them, actualize them, reflect on them, try to memorize them if you can, right? Because if you have some of these things memorized, they essentially now start to inform decisions a little bit more, right? إِنَّمَا الْعَمَالُ بِالنِّيَاتِ. Indeed, actions are because of intentions. If you carry that with you, it's going to be easier to kind of turn back to it in moments where you need something to inform decision making, you know? And so here, this particular hadith is broken into a few different ways. And we looked at some of it in regards to the first chunk that talks about like the halal and the haram being clear, right? Like marriage is clearly a permissible thing. And in Islam, fornication is not permissible. You know, we said that giving somebody a gift is clearly permissible. It's halal. Theft is haram. You know, so if you break it down with tangible examples, there are things that one can identify very clearly in these prisms of what is permissible and what is not permissible. And just to recap really quickly, when we had this spectrum that we talked about, the ahkam sharia, that was the obligatory, what's called fard in Arabic, the recommended, the mustahab, you had in the middle what's mubah, neutral, then you had what's makruh, disliked, and then you had what's haram, impermissible. Everything to the other end from haram is permissible in most instances. Even at times, what is makruh can be something that you can engage in. So what's comparatively allowed in Islam is 1,000 times more than what is not allowed. Do you know? And so that area now where there's doubt, like we talked about that a little bit, or a little bit, more than a little bit, actually, right? But certain the principles that kind of are drawn from our tradition, from a legal standpoint, how do you deal with certain spiritual elements that are purposeful to cast doubt within a person? And we want to move into some of the latter part of this, where the Prophet ﷺ is now creating some a principle again that is illustrated further by the example he gives of these animals grazing in this space that is not for them to graze. The notion that something is haram in our religion is not because I feel or I think or I want, meaning it's religiously prohibited, strictly prohibited. it's rooted in evidentiary text. And so we said in matters of worship, everything is considered to be impermissible unless it is evidentiary based that it's permissible. I can't just make worship up. It's got to be rooted in a text. In non-matter worships, matters of non-worship, the default is everything is permissible unless there's a reason or a basis to say that it's impermissible. Do you know? And where and how these two things have areas also that render gray. The idea now that says if someone walks in the gray area, it's the essential equivalent of just getting into the haram. Where you start to tread close to it is what brings you to it, is the idea. None of it's going to make sense or feel like anything other than burden if you haven't sat down and reflected on who, like, the lawmaker is in all of this to begin with. There's a paradox to decision making that when you don't make a choice, you've essentially chosen. And for many of us, we grow up with these terms, halal and haram. If you're born into a Muslim family, right, you are not taught to celebrate God or reflect on who the divine is before you're told, don't do this, do that, rules. We have a lot of converts in our community, right? Just last week, 4 people took their shahada at the center. Yesterday, someone came to my house. On Friday, there was 2 people at Jummah. On Wednesday last week, someone did in my office. Every week, there's a lot of people who are engaged in this. There's a young woman who came here some months ago, and she sat with me, and her entry point into Islam was a significant other who was Muslim, which is a reality for many people, right? And it's a beautiful way for someone to enter into Islam because you already then have like a friend who's there with you in the journey. And if you're the means through which somebody is getting closer to God, like that's a nice thing also. Do you know what I mean? And as she is getting more integrated into the process and now meeting like potential in-laws and others, she's sitting in my office and the tears just pour out. And she said, I'm trying to learn this religion and all these people are giving me are rules, you know? And if you're in a place where you try to engage hadith like this as a primary, rather than first approaching it through the prism of faith, you're going to read into it a voice that's everybody that's taught you religion at some point in your life. And if the Sunday school teacher or the guy on the pulpit or the parent who misused and weaponized religion to kind of control in some capacity, their voice pops up, then it's going to feel like this is burdensome in some way. But the reality is that this religion is rooted on the idea that we're going to all make mistakes. The notion that gets us is twofold. One, shaitan, the devil, wants you to believe that because you've slipped, it's not the act in and of itself that he gets you to do, but because of it, you're somehow now not able to have a relationship with God. It becomes the identifying variable of who you are in your practice. The other thing that comes up is then I have this kind of guard in front of me, not an armor, but a barrier that doesn't allow for me to admit that I actually can do things that I shouldn't be doing. So it becomes hard for me to apologize to people. It becomes hard for me to seek forgiveness. It also becomes hard for me to know how to necessarily forgive because I've never had anybody ask me for forgiveness when they've wronged me. And it creates now this conundrum where we carry a lot of hurt and a lot of heaviness. And then on top of it, it's like, I just keep screwing up. There's nothing good with me. The whole notion is that you're going to make mistakes. You can't have spiritual growth if there's nothing to improve upon. If everybody was in a place where everything they did was already in the realm of just doing it with immaculate beauty, what our tradition teaches us is that our Creator would get rid of all of us and replace us with a population that made mistakes so that He would have a creation to forgive. And then when you struggle, you actually struggle with something, it just means something different. It allows for you to just taste a little sweeter something when you have overcome or accomplished or achieved. You can revisit things that were given to you in certain ways, but not given with a recognition of how you can actually have relation to it that's your own and not somebody else's. Do you get what I mean? So you can't read a hadith like this and then throw your back against the wall, especially when nobody is even looking to judge you for anything. But at the end of a day, you inventory. At the end of a week, you inventory. And you sit and you think and you reflect. What was the good that came from me? What were the things that could have been done a little bit better? What are the things that I probably shouldn't be doing anymore? The other part you want to understand before we look at some of the rest of this is a lot of people turn to haram, not because they're bad people, but a lot of people turn to haram in an absence of community support systems. They don't have people to lean on. So when there's heaviness, you have to numb like what you're feeling. I can't experience this pain anymore. You have to smoke something or drink something to lose awareness or consciousness. You get to a place where things start to just feel heavy and you're in a place where you want some moments of just clarity. When you can work with yourself and work with others to be able to celebrate the overcoming of haram. There's a woman in our community who struggled with alcoholism. She came to see me. We talked about it. She said, I don't want to drink anymore. I said, good. And we had some kind of meetings. And then at some point, she said, Thanksgiving's coming up and I'm really worried. And I said, why? She said, I'm going to go to my house and all my family drinks. And I don't know what they're going to do if they see me not drinking. So I said, just give me a call if there's any problems and we'll figure it out. I didn't hear from her. And then a week or two passed. And I didn't know what was going on. And then I saw her and I said, was everything okay? She said it was amazing. I went home. My family was so drunk, they didn't know that I wasn't drinking. And I said, I guess that's a good thing. I don't know. But then she started really working at it. And there was days that were easy and days that were hard. But then the days that were easier started to exceed the days that were hard. And when she went 6 months without drinking anything, I told her, get your friends together. Let's go out to have dinner. We didn't have to tell them why we were going out, but we were celebrating her. Do you understand? And this is hadith. The Prophet ﷺ says, ittaqil maharim takuna abadan nas, that refrain from that which is haram. You will be the most virtuous of people. He's not saying go and read more Quran or pray more or do these things. But it's not about doing, it's about keeping yourself from doing. And the level of virtue is not based off of like human validation. Mashallah, look at how much charity he gives. Mashallah, look at how much Quran he knows. But it's virtue within the eyes of the divine. That certain things are just hard. And it's hard. There's gradations to haram as well. And you can see, like right now, how crazy it is. People who are driven by ego, lust, just their own selfish desires, they don't even care that they're killing babies. It's just straight up murder every single day. But you don't want to be in a place where that comparative mode in and of itself starts to now diminish what the impact is. Because the hadith says that when we're engaging in this thing of haram, it's leaving a dark spot on our heart. And this hadith is going to circle back to the heart at the end of this. And that's what starts to cloak. That's the effect of like numbing. So why is this relevant to us? Everybody's going through some crap, man. So you want to be in a place where you check in on people. Somebody walks in, you don't elevate yourself by denigrating somebody. But you're in a place where you learn someone's name, you build a friendship and a relationship before you're jumping to just offer advice that isn't talking to someone, but talking at someone. You know what I mean? And that can't be just out of convenience. If I'm going to walk with this woman overcoming her alcoholism, then I have to make myself available based off of what she's going through. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? And this is why we have hadith, like prophetic narrations that say, even like smiling, meeting someone with a cheerful face is a charity. You can uplift somebody, you can help them, make them feel as if they are entitled to stand on a prayer mat, that God wants them to hear, like to pray to him. Do you get what I mean? If I could give you a starting point on any of this, a couple of things inward and outward, try not to lie so much. And people lie over the dumbest things. It's going to kill your heart. It doesn't mean you're just blunt and rude, you know? There's a hadith where an old woman gives grapes to the companions and the Prophet. Whenever there's food, the Prophet shares it with people. He eats last. Leaders eat last. These grapes are given. The Prophet eats all of them. And the companions, like, what just happened? And the Prophet said that these were sour grapes, and I was worried if you had eaten them, you would have made this elderly woman feel bad for giving them to us. Do you get what I mean? He's not going to say to the old woman, these are gross. That's not what we're talking about. But honesty is the base characteristic of this tradition. Other things that you want to stay away from in terms of haram, don't gossip. You are hurting people, and the spiritual impact is that your good deeds go into their accounts as you accrue bad deeds. Hasan al-Basri was a spiritual master of our tradition. People would accuse him of gossiping, and he would say to them that, who do you think you are that the likes of you would benefit from my deeds on the Day of Judgment? When he found out people would gossip about him, he would send them gifts with notes inside. And the notes would say, thank you for giving me the benefits of your good deeds. I will relish them when I stand in front of Allah on the Day of Judgment. Do you know? It's just paradigm shifts. You base your relationships on things that are rooted in actual, like, bonds that are meaningful. You come and learn together, you pray together, you volunteer together, you check in on each other. You don't have to have a false trust. It goes back to lying. It's a false trust that I will share something with you that we both know someone doesn't want us to be saying about somebody else. Other things you want to avoid in terms of haram, don't be racist. It's crazy haram. Don't think you're better than someone by virtue of where you come from. The amount of money you have, the parents you were born to, you had no say in any of that. Abuse, oppression in any of its forms, not okay. No validation, no justification. You're killing your heart. And then when we look at it in a different category, don't consume haram. The permissible is a lot greater than what is impermissible. And in our spiritual tradition, if you are able to control your consumption, usually aligned to like your stomach, but you think about it also in terms of what you watch, what you listen to, etc. When you're consuming it, it's literally going through your sensory organs and it's going to now nourish your body in a way that's problematic. So you just try your best. You wean yourself off certain things. We came back from Umrah a couple of weeks ago. I had gone to Egypt and came back to New York. And then I had gone to Toronto and came back to New York. And then I had gone to South Africa and came back to New York. And then I went to Mecca and Medina and came back to New York. And some of it, relief work, Allah make things easy for our sisters and brothers in Gaza and end the occupation that's taking place there. Cape Town is amazing. And they definitively love Palestine. And this minister that you see all over the news, I got to hear her speak live before any of it went public about what they were putting into the courts and how they were standing for our brothers and sisters in Palestine. But also on all of these things, I was eating the way one would eat when they're traveling around the world. And people are nice, they just kept feeding me. And so when I came back from Umrah, I said, I gotta cut out like all this sugary stuff that I keep eating. When I came back from Umrah, I was the heaviest I've ever been in my life. My kids, I love them, they're really mean to me. And my son Kareem, he gave me a hug, and then he took a step back, and then he squeezed my stomach. He was like, Baba, it's never been this soft before. I was like, thanks, man. The 4 or 5 days after I said processed sugars are gonna get cut out, and it's not the first time. I went 4 years without eating any of this junk, and then COVID hit, and it hit really hard. Those 4 days, my head hurt. I was like easily irritable. There was times I was sitting next to my wife on the couch and I would say, don't give me anything I ask you for. And after 20 minutes, I would say, just give me a piece of chocolate. And she'd be like, no. And I'm like, just a little piece of chocolate. I'm not even joking. It's not easy, right? But you have a plan or a strategy that says, I'm gonna wean myself off of it, because whether I buy into it or not, it's having an impact on my inside. You get what I mean? And as the hadith proceeds, it now gives this amazing illustration of where one goes in the realm of permissibility and they draw closer and closer to a boundary that they're not supposed to come to. And this is where people say that which leads to haram is haram in and of itself. Because if you don't catch yourself prior to getting to the limit, then the only place you can go is crossing the limit. Do you get what I mean? And it starts somewhere and then ends someplace else. And then shaitan gets you where it's hard. We are at a university. I work with people of all backgrounds. The number of young people who have relationship issues, challenges, as they're trying to get to a place of figuring out what love means to them. Two students here a long time ago came to sit in my office. They're miserable. And I was like, what's going on? And they're like, we want to get married to each other. And I was like, that's clearly a sad conversation. Like, why do you look so down if you want to get married to each other? And he said, on Friday night, we were studying in the library. It was late, so I walked her back to her dorm. She said, do you want to come and eat something? And I said, sure. And we went there, and her roommates weren't there. And one thing led to the next, and then they committed zina. Then the next day, they felt very guilty. And so they said, we're never going to do this again. So again, they studied, walked back home. Would you like to have dinner? Nobody's else in the room. They've already made a promise. We're not going to do it again. And then, of course, the same thing happens. Now they're sitting in my office and they say, maybe we should never talk to each other again. Maybe we should just like forget about this. Allah is showing us that, you know, we're not good for each other. I'm like, what are you talking about? What are you trying to prove? That you don't love each other? That you don't care about each other and you don't want to do the things that people who are in love with each other want to do? But if you have boundaries and parameters that you're setting yourself aligned to, then you have to know yourself enough before you put yourself in the situation that's going to cause you to slip. And this is why I'm telling you, shaitan's goal is to not get you to just do the act. It's all the other mess that comes into your head after the fact. And they're sitting there wrestling with it, struggling with it. What do you think Fajr was like for them that day? What do you think it was like when they made dua and they looked at their hands and they felt ugly and disgusted with themselves? If you believe that you can't be forgiven by God for something, it's not just telling you something about you, but it's telling you who you believe God to be. And that's like the whole idea. So here, the Prophet ﷺ is engaged in this conversation. And he's telling people, and this kid is picking up on it because it's an important thing. You're not about what people will think or what will so-and-so think or such-and-such think. There's literal companions of the Prophet who struggled with drinking alcohol, struggled with zina. They would come to the, you got to make zina halal for me, O Messenger of God. Like, they just couldn't deal with it. Do you think they all didn't also pray next to each other at Maghrib time? And do you have hadith where companions are like, that's the guy that was telling the Prophet he struggles with zina? Or they're a community all together, knowing that they all need to lean on each other and support one another. Doesn't mean you got to get up and tell everybody your business, right? Here's all the haram that I do, guys. You know, love me for it. No, that's not what I'm saying. But you have an element that recognizes people's humanity. And the whole idea is that there's still opportunity to gain because you come back stronger when you stand on your feet the next time, right? The prayer of the sinner is quite often much sweeter than the prayer of the saint. Because when you've struggled and you've slipped, you really know what it actually means to pray a little bit differently than somebody who doesn't stumble, which is just fundamentally not possible. They're just not being honest and real with themselves. Do you get what I mean? So here the Prophet is giving us this illustration. And when he says it's like a shepherd who herds his sheep too close to preserve sanctuary, and they will eventually graze in it. Every king has a sanctuary, and the sanctuary of Allah is what he has made haram. What I'd like you to do is just turn to the person next to you. What is it that you take away from this part of the hadith? You talk to the person. If you don't know their name, more people have trickled in. What is it that this part of the hadith kind of means to you, or even some of what we've talked about already? We take a few minutes to just discuss, and then we'll come back and talk about it. But go ahead. Guys, can you move in this way so people who are praying, they have room to come to the front of the room? If you guys can move on, if you can come in this way, that'd be great. Khalid, can you move the tables back a bit? Yeah, no. Thank you. From Okay, so what are some of the things that this part of the hadith makes you think about? The shepherd is bringing the sheep to graze in this way. What do we discuss?
I was just talking to Anwar, okay, and my friend from Yemen. I forgot the name already. So, you know, like, halal is clear, haram is clear, and there is like a borderline between them. And the more that you would practice, the better that your heart would tell you when you are about, you know, like to do something. And he was just trying to resemble it like a shepherd who is trying to protect his sheep.
Okay, so about this part with the shepherd and the sheep, like what stands out to us here? Any thoughts? Are you looking away so that you don't have to talk to me? Is that what it is? Should I just stare at you and make you uncomfortable? Yeah? Yeah. Great. Go ahead. Keep going.
Yeah. And then, like, maybe you do something that's haram once, and you think back and recognize, all right, it's not enough that you just purely stay in haram, but you stay in haram in a way that doesn't get you to that trigger again.
In this part of the hadith, are you the shepherd or are you the sheep? Like, which one is you? Because there's multiple characters here right now, right? The shepherd is drawing the sheep towards their grazing land and brings them potentially too close to a part of the land that they're not supposed to get to. Does it make sense? The Prophet is an amazing teacher, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And you want to think about where he's at. He's in Medina, we know, because Nu'man ibn Bashir, the narrator of the hadith, is born after they migrate to Medina, right? Medina as a city is very different from Mecca. If you come to the Sira classes, we talked about this last semester, right? The difference between Taif and Medina and Mecca. Medina is a lot of swampland. When the companions came, they were getting sick a lot. They didn't like it there so much. The Prophet makes dua for people to love Medina, because his companions didn't like Medina, right? Now everybody loves Medina. If you've been to Medina, you cannot help but fall in love with Medina. Do you know what I mean? So here, they're in this place where, how do they function in this like Bedouin tribal society that is still situated in the establishment of a city in Medina? What does it mean when you're talking about a shepherd with sheep? And his ability to articulate and illustrate in ways that actually create now an opportunity for any person to find themselves in a place of being able to relate or at least understand and fathom, like the illustration, the metaphor. So you got to get it in your head right now. There's a shepherd. Do shepherds have one sheep in your head? How many sheep does a shepherd have? Huh? You got a lot of sheep, right? There's more than one sheep. This shepherd is taking their sheep around to eat. And now, the shepherd leads them someplace. Which one are you? Are you the shepherd or are you the sheep? Before you answer, because I want everyone to talk about it, right? Because at a face value, you can walk away and read a hadith like this. Just like the other hadith we read. And it's like it means only this thing. There's very few things in our religious text that only mean one thing. You can take so much from different stuff. This is a beautiful example of how the Prophet teaches and how he's effective as a communicator and an illustrator, right? He didn't just say, don't go to haram because then you'll do haram and you're haram, right? The way people tell us. But he's giving them now something that they can visually comprehend and understand. And you have to think about it in your head. Shepherd taking the sheep. Which one is me in the hadith? Am I the shepherd or am I the sheep? If you turn to the people around you and just talk about it a bit, right? What does it make you think about as you're visualizing it? And you hold on to your thought too, because then we'll come back and start with that. Does it make sense? If you see somebody not talking, just bring them in to talk with you. If you talk a lot, let other people talk. Listen to them, right? And it's not about negating somebody's ideas. This is how we learn from each other. What does it look like to you? And which one is me in this situation? Am I the sheep or am I the shepherd? Am I both? Am I neither? Go ahead. Do you want to come sit closer with everybody? Yeah. You sure? Should we have some people come join you in conversation? Oh, yeah? Okay. Just as you're talking, don't stop talking, but you can hear my voice, but keep talking to each other. If you're not the shepherd or you're not the sheep, then who is or what is? What's the shepherd then and what's the sheep? Does it make sense? Let's talk for a little bit more and then we'll come back and discuss.
Every time I read it, I'm right.
Okay, let's come back. So, who is who in this part of the hadith? Like, there's nothing without meaning in Allah's plan, right? And the Messenger, alayhi salam, is representative, as best in a human form, of who Allah intends for him to be. His words are just meticulous. They're amazing. So, who's the sheep in this? Who's the shepherd? Like, which one am I? Which one are you, potentially? Right? What do we think? What do we talk about? Yeah.
It's, through our conversations, we've seen ourselves, like, as on the shepherd role. One of the things we mentioned is that we attend classes, and we seek the knowledge. From that, when we seek the knowledge, then we share it with our brothers and sisters, the younger generations. So they're in the sheep area, transitioning in as they continue to practice and advance in their knowledge, then they get to that shepherd role. That makes sense. Yeah.
Okay, great. Other thoughts? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, it could be. Yeah, Jazakallah khair. Other thoughts? You were going to say something?
Myself as a shepherd and the sheep being the different struggles you have, all the things that you're wrestling with and trying to keep in control in the right space and crossing over into where they should not be.
Yeah.
Abdullah shared something. He said that the shepherd is the soul, right?
Yeah.
And the sheep are the body. So I think part of that is you got to govern where you allow yourself, as in the body, to be and stay away from sin in that way.
Yeah, there's hadith, the Prophet alayhi salam. All of these are great answers. Anybody else have anything else they reflected on that we want to share? Yeah.
Actually, both, depending upon the situation. As he had said, sometimes you are the shepherd yourself if you're guiding yourself, but as you get close to that haram, the sheep mentality takes over. In this scenario right now, in this situation, especially my situation, I see you as the shepherd, myself as the sheep. So I'm looking for you for guidance and knowledge. My children who haven't embraced Islam, they may see me as the shepherd and then they're the sheep. So I think it's more relative to, I think it can be seen in many, either or, depending upon the situation that you're personally experiencing at that point in life. And it can be applied to, and recognizing, am I right now a role model, a figurehead? You know, as I was saying to him too, like, I'm new to Islam, he's been in it. If I saw him doing something out there, I would see him as my shepherd and say, because he did that, well, that must be halal, because he's been a Muslim his whole life, and I'm not. So I think it also gives a lesson on, like, being that proper example, because you don't know who's watching. And you don't know who might, you know, that might be a sheep that's watching, or it might be another fellow shepherd, but you should always strive to stay away from those boundaries.
Amazing. Right? You can extrapolate so much, but you could also just gloss over this part of the hadith and never sit down and take a breath and say, something is driving something. There's the driver and like the one that is driven. What's going on here? And what's compelling me? What motivates me? What am I compelling towards? What am I motivating towards? And the Prophet tells us in another hadith, قُلُكُمْ رَائِن, that all of you are shepherds. وَقُلُكُمْ مَسُولًا رَيَتِي, and all of you are responsible for your sheep. That dual role is something that we've like extrapolated a lot when we're looking at the Prophet's upbringing in the Sirah class on Wednesdays, right? So you gotta take information from one place and apply it to other places. So you can not have to have like a quantifiable relationship to knowledge, because you're not meant to be a dictionary or a thesaurus that just memorizes things. Like, you can have little bits of information and go really far with them based off of how you create a prism of just understanding the world through like new information. So here, there's capacity to be a driver as well as the one that is driven. What is your shepherd? And what falls under what you are a shepherd of? In any scenario, the shepherd, what they shepherd as a shepherd, is not theirs to begin with. Because if I'm shepherding sheep, it's not my sheep that I'm shepherding. I'm shepherding somebody else's sheep. Right? What? If you give me your sheep to look after, you gave me 10 sheep. I better come back with 10 sheep, right? Right? And if I took your sheep someplace else and fed them from places that were terrible, I'm still responsible for where I led them. Everything that you have in our religion is God's to begin with. The notion of choice that comes under like supremacist driven models of liberalism tells us that liberation is in this idea. I can do whatever I want. Islam doesn't tell you you cannot do whatever you want. It just says you're going to have to explain why you did it the way you did it. And that this thing that you were given as the vessel for your soul, even that doesn't belong to you. And when you can see things as gifts, not thinking that just because I have it, it means I deserve it, I start to think about, well, what's the reason as to why I was given it? And how do I utilize it? Everybody's got different spiritual gifts. Do you know what I mean? Some of us can sing really well, right? Some of us should never sing in our lives. Do you know what I mean? Right? We have talents that are coming from God. But in being able to understand what drives me, am I being driven by the validation of a world that is purposeful in trying to create psychological shackling of me? Am I unwilling to acknowledge the control Shaitan has over me, or whiteness has over me, or capitalism has over me? Do I have a core belief structure that I understand, positive or negative, how it draws me to the decisions that I make? And what are the things that I am driving then in turn towards things that don't make any sense? Do you get what I'm saying? So the dual role of the shepherd and the sheep is applicable. The sheep in and of itself has limited foresight. It literally can only see right in front of it. It requires the shepherd to be what it is that is defining its trajectory. And this is where the end of the hadith brings it all together. Ala wa inna fil jasadi mudghatan إذا صلحت صلح الجسد كله وإذا فسدت فسد الجسد كله على وهي القلب. That indeed in your jasad, in your physical body, there is a morsel of flesh. If it's good, everything is good. If it's not good, everything is not good. It's your heart. That's what you want to be the shepherd. You don't want the nafs, the lower self, to be the shepherd. You don't want irreconciled pain to be the shepherd. You don't want ego and arrogance to be the shepherd. You don't want insatiable lust and desire to be the shepherd. You don't want I feel, I think, I want to be the shepherd. You want the heart to be the shepherd. How can the heart be the shepherd if you don't take care of the heart? How can the heart be in control? There's a hadith where a companion comes to ask the Prophet about acts of goodness and what they can be doing. The Prophet tells him to reach out hands to people and to speak good words. But in the midst of the hadith, the Prophet says, "Hal tamliku lisanak? Hal tamliku yadak?" That are you in control of your tongue? Are you in control of your hand? But it uses the word that derives from Malik. Like, are you the master of your body? Or is your body the master of you? And if you reflect within yourself and say, what drives you? A lot of us are driven by pain. May Allah grant us healing. It's not the sheep's fault that the shepherd is driving them through it. But they still at the end are going to be the ones that are going to get screwed the most. I have anger, I have sadness, I have grief, I have anxiety. This is why also it's important to understand the dual role. Because if you are driving people towards pain, they still are going to respond to it. And then there is consequence. So the notion of that which leads to haram is haram itself is not just, man, you're sitting on the bar stool. Did you think the drink wouldn't go in your mouth? But make it broader. When you put adult emotions in children's hearts, what do you think it's going to bring them to later on? When you make jokes at the expense of people, mocking, ridiculing them, when you don't take serious relationships, you treat significant others like you would treat a cup of ice cream, always wondering if something else is better than what you have in front of you. And what are you driving people towards? And what from your heart is defining those decisions? The nature of the heart is something that's important to understand because you can gauge from a metric standpoint where your heart's at based off of just how you treat people and you treat things. You want to know what your heart's actually at? What kind of choices and decisions are you making? The Prophet had a wakeful heart. Tanama naya wala yanama qalbi, he says when he's asked about his sleep, that my eyes they sleep, but my heart does not sleep. So it's not just something that's random. We're not surprised that he smiles at everybody, that he greets people that he knows and does not know, treats everybody the same, whether they are rich or poor, whether they are Muslim or not. Because what should somebody look like in terms of what they're doing, if their heart is doing okay? If you got clutter in your heart, it doesn't mean that you're the cause of it, but you got to love yourself enough to do something about it. You got to also love yourself enough to not be the reason that someone else gets clutter in their heart. And that happens in two ways, that you are either initiating it or you are just carrying on generational pain that has to stop someplace. And that's why what we were saying before is really important. Somebody walks into a house of God and they find everything other than the presence of God. They come in and they get directed to a back alleyway because women are stuck in the basement and nobody's even there to talk to them. They come and the languages that are spoken are not common amongst everybody, but everything is just catered to a majority, not a minority. There's a woman who came to Jummah here who told me that she comes from Germany or Switzerland, one of these countries. And she said, I watch your khutbahs here every week. I said, that's very nice of you. And she said, if we didn't listen to this where I'm at, there'd be no place else to go. And I was like, you know, sister, there's masjids in your country. And she said, they don't speak in English or in Dutch or German or whatever else. When I went to Holland, Holland is filled with Muslims. And I sat with a group of people who were converts. And I'm on a project studying integration patterns and kind of domestic policies, right? And I'm meeting with ministers who are like smiling. Politicians are the same everywhere, man. And all these like Moroccans and Berber speaking and Turks, they don't know. Nobody's ever talked to them about like privilege and all this kind of stuff that stems from race and ethnicity. And as we're talking, they're like talking about how it's great that they all live in their own like kind of places. And this like man who's a minister is saying, you know, we try our best. We bring buses to them as, you know, our kind of development plans necessitate moving people. And I was like, they're just gentrifying you and smiling in your face as they do it. As I'm talking to people on the ground who are not Turks or Moroccans, and every masjid is either speaking in Arabic, Berber, or Turkish, I said, where do the Dutch people go when they want to learn about Islam? And then across these cultural communities, every one of them said something uniform, regardless of their distinct cultural background, whether they're Moroccan or Turk or whatever. Why would Dutch people want to go to a mosque? I said, what do you mean, man? But do you understand what this hadith is telling you? People don't have people to lean on. They're going to still try to settle the pain they have inside. This society feeds you in pursuit of numbness. It wants you to over-medicate. It wants you to engage in what is going to just render unconsciousness and a lack of awareness, and then to just feed into it habitually again and again and again. And it builds it by teaching egocentricity that says, don't ask somebody how they're doing. It's crazy the way this society functions. When there are economic downturns, the solutions that they run are that they have mass layoffs of people in companies. Can you imagine? People are having an economic downturn, and in the midst of that, they go to work every week wondering if at the end of the week they'll still have a job. Some of you experience this, don't you? It's purposeful to create that level of control. You see what I mean? And you know why people do this nonsense? Because their hearts are not what the shepherd is. They're being governed by hawa, desire. They're being governed by the nafs, the lower self. They're being governed by dunya, the materialistic world. They're being governed by waswasa, shaitan's whispers. May Allah protect us from these things. So what is my shepherd? What is it driving me towards? You reflect on it. What pushes me? What compels me? What motivates me? And in the beginning, the Prophet saying, hey man, haram is clear, halal is clear. There's a lot more on this end than that end. And then summates it with, this is what should be the sovereign over you. Make it the heart. Make it the qalb. But make it one that is righteous, wakeful. So do things for your heart. I want you to think for a minute, just as we wrap up. If we looked in your routines, your schedules, not what is forthcoming, but what transpired. So there's actual record. We went back and wrote down minute by minute from this day that is already completed to yesterday till a week ago. Where could you show me evidence in your schedule that your heart is important to you? And then just think, what are the things that make your heart feel uplifted? You know you like being around certain people. Why are you not around them more? You know certain spaces bring you up. Why do you not orient your routines around these spaces? You know certain things on the other end just bring you down. It doesn't mean you just run away from it. You're a shepherd. You're responsible for sheep. So you draw the rest of yourself towards things that help to compensate. It takes a little bit of light to push away darkness. But if all you do is immerse yourself in darkness, then why wouldn't the world feel dark? Do you get what I mean? Nu'man ibn Bashir radiallahu anh is a child narrating this hadith. He's going to remember in what we know him to be, an excellent orator, eloquent in his communication, a poet. You can't be a poet if your heart's not in it. Right? What artist do you know that doesn't have like a piece of themselves personally? And how constrained do they get when they have to create art that is not what they want to be creating? Do you get what I mean? So this little boy, 8 years of age, hearing these words from the best of creation, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he's going to grow up knowing this religion is about your heart. It's not about haram and halal only, but even halal and haram is a subcategory under your heart. Do you get it? Does that make sense? So the hadith is also telling us, how do you teach religion to children in Islam? Do you just give them a list of do's and don'ts? Or is he explaining conceptually what all of this is about? What makes you you? Because then it fills default gaps, right? If I got a heart inside of me, what else do I have in me, O Messenger of God? Because you're not just a body and a heart. Something's got to be the shepherd if it's not the heart. Something's got to be the sheep, right? So what else makes you you? You have akal, intellectual capacity. You have the nafs, the lower self. You have irada, sheer will and determination. You also have all of your memories, all of your experiences, everything you've ever felt, your thoughts, they're all within you. And you can't just have something arbitrarily assigned saying that this is my shepherd. It's going to fluctuate day after day. Do you get what I mean? But as consistently as possible, you want it to be the heart. The last thing I'm going to say before I'm going to ask you to turn to people next to you, and then those who are here for the second halakha, we started this a little bit late, so we're going to wrap up in 2 minutes, and then we'll move into that one. We'll probably take a break to pray Isha before, just so people can get up and stretch legs. If you know somebody is like a good person, and they have a good heart, then you should try to spend time with that person. Because you don't need people's permission to take their characteristics. And if you spend time with people who are just like money, 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 right? Then that's just what it's going to be. Do you know what I mean? You might not like it, but it's going to impact you here. So if you know, being around these people, being in these places, it brings me light. You start to flourish inwardly by surrounding yourselves with company that's going to also help bring healing as well as help you flourish inwardly. And you find people who their love for you is not rooted in the parts of you that remind them of themselves, but they love you as a full person. So that they can help teach you how to love you and let your heart be in a place where you're then able to say that, yes, this is the most precious part of me. I want this to be my shepherd. So I'd like you to do between this week and next week, when we move on to hadith number 7, you go home, pull out a notebook, write at the top, what is my shepherd? What is it that drives me? When I'm in charge, what am I like being in that seat? What am I driving people towards? You get what I mean? And just reflect on it. Not in a way that's self-deprecating, in a way that's productive. In order to get to where you want to be, you have to be honest with where you are in this moment, right? So if I come back from Umrah, and I'm sitting on my couch, and I'm looking at Priya, I'm like, just give me the chocolate, right? What is driving my decision at that point in time? You know? And I have to be honest with myself. You're not me. If I'm embarrassed by me, then I've already given Shaitan victory over me, right? I'm not embarrassed by me. I enjoyed eating all that stuff that I ate. But I know that that's not going to be what's going to bring me to where I need to be. I got to get it in check. Does it make sense? You just got to be honest with yourself too, right? And then as you try to detangle all that other stuff that wants to be the shepherd, it's going to get in the way. And it's going to say, no, man, your kids are asleep. Your wife is asleep. You work so hard. All these people, they rely on you. What's the problem? Just eat a Reese's peanut butter cup, right? But sometimes small victories actually render deep impact. And then I can get up 5 days later and say, as miserable as that mess was, and you know it's crazy? When you're trying to do it, maybe it's just me. I walk into places, people are really nice, but people give me stuff. You know, we went to this thing, my kids and I went to a program that was happening here, this like weekend seminar we were doing on the proofs of prophethood with Al-Maghrib Institute. And this is like day two of me not trying to eat any sugar. And we walked in and they're like handing out chocolate bars to everybody, right? So they're like, Imam Khalid, just have some chocolate from us. And now I'm going to look like a jerk. What am I going to do, right? And then my kids walk in and come out. They're like, Baba, they have all of these things. There's like gushers falling out of their hands. And they're like, look, Baba, it's so great. And of course, the people who are there are very nice. And they're like, you don't have to pay for it. Just take it. Take as much as you want. And I'm like, no, just get it away from me. I want it. I can like smell it through the back. That's like how much my nafs is in control at that time. And I take a breath and say, like, do I control me or does my stomach control me? And then 5 days later, I can look in the mirror. I don't need like anybody else. I can just say to myself, good job, man. You got through it. Now do it for another 5 days.
What happened after 5 days?
Huh?
What happened after 5 days?
I just stopped craving it. Okay. You got to know the nature of the nafs is that it's lazy. Not only does it compel you to laziness, but in and of itself, it's lazy. So if you can combat it for a few days, whatever your lower self, your ego is asking you to do or compelling you to do for a matter of time, it's going to wear off because its inherent characteristics are that of laziness. It's not going to just keep getting you in the same place again and again. Do you know what I mean? Then, like a couple of days ago, I ate a piece of chocolate with some peanut butter, and then I looked at my wife, and I said, it doesn't taste good. And I was really sad, you know, because the same nonsense happened when I cut it out for 4 years. And I tried to eat something, and it tasted really bitter. Do you know what I mean? And then I tried to eat an Oreo, and then I looked at her, and she was like, what do you think? And I was like, I don't like it. And I felt really sad, because I like eating these things. But that's what happens, right? You get acclimated. It's remarkable the way God has made your bodies that you're able to adapt. Fasting is a very powerful tool. And if you can like detox from something for just a few days, it pretty much gets out of your system at that point, you know? All kinds of substances, including like certain types of foods. And then you do something for 30 days, right? You don't want to like first day of Eid go nuts, you know? Because you're just gonna bring it all back in unless you're doing it with intentionality. And you know, like, this is something that isn't what the norm is going to be. Do you get what I mean? Okay, let's take 2 quick minutes. You turn to the person next to you. What are you taking away from our conversation today? And then we'll take a pause and make Isha. If you don't know the names of the persons, just share some names. And we'll come back and discuss. I'm You're not supposed to be talking to me right now. Why are you ruining everything? You gotta talk to those people over there. I don't want, huh? She does need help, doesn't she need help? What do you need help with?
How do you cook one processed sugar?
It's not in everything. It's in lots of things. It's not everything. Yeah. Yeah. It is. You screwed. What else can I tell you? Life's gonna suck for us. Okay. Let's come back. What are some of the things we're taking away from today? Maybe a couple of people, huh?
No more chocolate.
No more chocolate? That wasn't the point of the conversation. Right? Huh? What are we taking away from today? Maybe one or two people quickly, and then we'll take a break. Anybody? Yeah.
Definitely, we all love chocolate. I figured, you know, that came up in the subject with desserts. But one of the other things that we see is time as well. What do we spend our time on, right? And I think that's one important. You mentioned earlier, it's time management, with discipline ourselves, right? And spending the appropriate time, you know, so we can benefit from it. It's not going to come back, right?
Yeah, great. Anything else? Takeaways from today?
I think like a summary is we should be the drivers rather than being driven by, you know, like any behaviors or desires or sins or flaws. So this requires, like you said, that we should have like a good heart, which can better guide us just to maintain the good things.
Yeah, so you just spend some time thinking, what do I do for my heart? How do I make the heart what it is that's in control? It doesn't mean you have to like abandon like yummy things. That's not the point of the conversation, right? But just being able to understand how all of you is connected to the rest of you. And it's kind of reflection on these hadith that have such deep meaning to them, do you know? That allow for us to be able to start to think about why we do what we do, what kind of pushes us in the ways that we are pushed. You know, what's really driving me? Most of us are not in a place where it's like what we believe is actually compelling us so much, right? And when you can turn to Quran and just understand the way that God sees you is the way you want to try to see yourself, so that you have an inherent understanding that you don't have to live in pursuit of like proving something to anybody. You know, you're good whether you're a doctor or not. You're good whether you're married or not. You're good whether you have children or not. You know, you're good whether you have a lot of money or not, right? Whether you have a house or not, whether you drive a fancy car or not. The people who are standing in lines as migrants right now, they're as good as the people who are serving them the food, right? It's not a metric of like what we understand certain things to be. Do you get what I'm saying, right? And when the heart is the driver, it allows us to find what's inherently beautiful in things around us. And even when there's just undeniable ugliness, it allows for us to be able to identify and see that and see where we can be a source of beauty in relation to what is inherently just vile and disgusting. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? Right? Okay. So next week we'll start. If people can try to come like as close to 6 as possible, that would be great. We'll go to like 7:15, and then we'll take a pause for Isha, and then we'll start the essentials of Ramadan class. So people who want to stick around for that today, we're going to be going through essentially all things Ramadan. Ramadan is really close to us. May Allah allow for us to reach it. And it's something that we want to be able to engage in. Whether you have never observed Ramadan in your life, or you've observed many Ramadans in your life, there's always an opportunity for us to draw like residual benefit from previous Ramadans, but also have new opportunities. Because even if the actions and rituals stay the same, we should be different every time we're turning to something, because there's change embedded in what our religion calls us towards. But sometimes the elements of change we're not necessarily able to embrace, because we're not thinking about the things we don't think about fully, do you know? So we start to look at things from different vantage points, do you know what I mean? Like, some of you have read this hadith we looked at well before. Have you ever thought about it in the ways that we're thinking about it today? And that's just where we benefit from hearing from each other. So if you can stick around, we'll go till probably about 8:30 or so tonight, and then we'll wrap up at that point, inshallah. So if people haven't made Isha, we'll call the Adhan. People want to make wudu, and then we'll call the Iqama in like 5 minutes, and then we'll start the essentials class in about 15 minutes or so, and then we'll wrap up for the night after that's done, inshallah. Yeah? Okay. Zakla, okay. All right, do you want to call the Adhan? How'd that go for you, man?
It was awesome.
It was okay.
I loved it.
Yeah, great.
I'm definitely going to be coming back. I have to wake up very early for work.
I wanted to stay
for this too, but I gotta sleep.
Let me know if anything comes up. Yeah. You need anything.
I'll be back. You'll see me again for sure this week.
All right, brother. Take care.